Luckily for you, the answer to the great question of life, the universe and everything is to be found in this podcast, A Worker's Guide to Everything. Sometimes cans, often bad language, always solid politics. This is the Trademark Belfast podcast. Listen out for Trademark regulars and very special comrade guests and fellow travellers talking all things lefty, Ireland and the world. We remain, as always, anti-sectarian, anti-racist and anti-fascist. Enjoy. Buenas tardes.
Hello and welcome once again to another Trademark podcast, which we have entitled The Worker's Guide to Everything. This is number 98, two off a ton, Sean. We're doing well. We're nearly there. We've got to say a special thanks to Sean Byers joining us today because he's joining us from his sick bed. God love him. We thought he had a dose of the shits, but apparently he's got ulcers. It's all very bad. It's not looking good at his end. So he's at
that. I don't make it to 100.
He could be on his way out, folks. This could be the last one. So enjoy it while you can. We're here today to talk about kind of the second half. We promised you last time, a couple of weeks ago, we put up a podcast where we discussed our understanding, if you like, of the rise of the far right in terms of understanding who they are and why they are in particular, and trying to give it a framework of political economy as well. Because as Sean so rightly said in the report we wrote last year, or 2 years ago for the union movement, is that, you know, we need a proper analysis of the far right, a concrete analysis of a concrete situation, because it's a far better vantage point to understand the world we live in than just kind of wringing our hands and liberal moralizing. And that's what we've attempted to do in the last few podcasts. And in this one, we've got another couple coming up where we're going to continue with this theme, interspersed with some other political economy stuff. Last time, Sean, we got to the point, we were kind of talking about definitions and like the differences between radical right and extreme right, and trying to understand all the various ways in which the right are manifesting themselves from skinhead groups, subcultures online, right the way through, of course, to, as we see in Italy and other places, forming governments, you know, within the European Union, which the European Union seems perfectly fine about, but that's maybe a debate for another day. But today I wanted to carry on because there's one subject matter we didn't kind of touch, and it's a really interesting one, actually. And it's the issue of populism, and in particular the word populism, because it's thrown around quite a lot. We've heard it an awful lot over the last 5 or 6 years. And it's thrown as much as the left as it is as the right. So if you want to silence somebody or make them sound just like stupid and worthless and pointless, you just call them a populist. So you can have a left. So Corbyn, for instance, in Britain was called a populist, and that was a way of dismissing him out of hand. And liberal commentators love to reduce analysis to that one word, don't they? It's an easy out for them. It's kind of a tool, isn't it, used by the establishment to kind of stigmatize anyone's politics or anyone's points of view. But the right, firstly, the question is, what do you understand by that term populism? And should we be using it even, or should we be dismissing it out of hand?
Yeah, well, there was a time around the immediate pre-COVID era, so as you said, around the Corbyn moment, where the populist label was being thrown around to the extent that it lost a lot of its meaning and utility. And as you pointed out, like, largely became a tool used by centrists and the political establishment to stigmatize political opponents, so including those who were opposing neoliberalism and austerity. So it's a way of saying that Corbyn and Mélenchon, for example, were just the same as Farage and Le Pen.
Yeah.
And you're able to dismiss them on that basis. There was a time when the likes of The Guardian were just pointing at everything they didn't like and called the populist. There was actually a study done, when I was doing research on this, there was a study done on the use of the label populism. And they found that The Guardian had become so accustomed to using the label that they even started publishing articles on populist gardening, populist cooking, and all of this other stuff. Like,
They kind of went down their own rabbit hole.
Yeah, just totally lost their own themselves. Enzo Traverso, who's a Marxist historian, he's written a lot about the far right. He makes the point, the simple point, that populism is a style of politics rather than an ideology, which is how it's been treated. And he basically goes on to characterize it as a rhetorical tool used to win over popular support across different classes. So among the working class, but beyond the working class. And it's a tool that kind of counterposes the virtues of the people as like hardworking, honest, authentic, and so on, to those of the elite and the political establishment who are corrupt, deceitful defenders of the status quo and all that.
But it's interesting, isn't it, how that counterposing of between the people and the elite has been used more effectively by the right, because the populist right, and I know that in Europe they love using that term, the populist right, they really use it quite a lot in the circles that we work in within the trade union movement. the populist, right, to use their term, have used it more effectively, haven't they, in terms of categorizing the elite versus the people. But who they categorize as the elite and who they categorize as the people is kind of hilarious at times, isn't it? But it's been really effective, hasn't it, that kind of differentiation, that rather than working class and ruling class, you've got elite versus the people, and they're kind of quite vague categorizations, aren't they? You can lump anyone into them.
Well, that's it, and that's why it's so appealing for those types of movements. Left-wing parties and movements have used it with some success up until fairly recently, so the likes of Corbyn, Melis Sean, Podemos, Sinn Féin even. But the far-right has been more effective in using it, and they're able to combine anti-establishment and anti-globalisation rhetoric with the sort of conception of the people that includes the likes of Nigel Farage, like a hedge fund manager, I think he was, in the City of London, but excludes marginal oppressed groups like immigrants, travellers, the LGBT community, and so on. Groups.
Yeah, they're part of the elite.
They're part of the elite. They're groups that the far right say are being given preferential treatment by the elite in terms of rights, housing, welfare, employment, you name it, at the expense of the hardworking people.
It's amazing, isn't it? Because some of the characteristics that the far right have used to define who the people are, and it's usually they've taken those characteristics on themselves. So, you know, the idea of people who are radicals, who are mavericks, who are bad-mannered, they say fuck and bollocks on TV, you know, they've got their kind of their common sense understanding the world, they're part of the people. So you get the likes of Boris De Feffel Johnson standing outside a pub, or Nigel Farage with a pint of beer in their hand, and people actually treat them as if they're part of the fucking working class, you know? But it seems to work.
Yeah, they're able to present themselves as like the insurgent outsider. We're not part of the establishment. You know, we're going to do things differently. We're just one of you. And that kind of thing. And it's been really effective.
Meanwhile, the elite then, the elite is characterized as you said, like they're corrupt, they're part of the bureaucratic, technocratic rulers of society. But more importantly, and I remember the Corbyn was a brilliant case study for us, if you think back to how he was attacked after 2017, and it was that, like, he was anti-British, he was treacherous, he wasn't loyal, he wasn't a patriot. Remember all that bollocks about when he was standing next to the war memorial, whatever they call that, the one in London, and he had a duffel coat on or something, and they sort of slaughtered him because, you know, he wasn't loyal enough and he wasn't a patriot enough, you know?
And I suppose there's a question as to whether populism as a strategy is as useful or appropriate for the socialist left. And you could argue that the demise of Corbyn, Podemos, Syriza, and so on reminds us of the limitations of populism from a socialist perspective, especially if you're trying to build a movement based on class interests. But I could go into this, that's not the point of the podcast. I suppose, if you look at the Corbyn movement, and even Podemos, you know, it was the populist strategy that placed a lot of stock in the charisma and personality of the leader in place of the hard slog of movement building. And the result is, if you cut off the head, be that through a coup or by tarnishing the leader's image, then the movement dies. And that's precisely what's happened in those cases. The second, probably bigger problem of populism from a socialist perspective is that it obscures class divisions and antagonisms within capitalism in favour of more ambiguous and vague categorizations, and it says that you're part of the people as long as you identify as such. So a landlord or employer who's in the lower strata of the capitalist class can situate themselves, and as Farage and so on have done, can place themselves as in the same block as their tenant or their low-paid worker. And that's a problem because class contradictions will always come to the surface, and eventually as a party or movement, you have to pick a side. And I think that's something that's a challenge that Sinn Féin, for example, are going to roll into.
Yeah, we noticed that particularly, I suppose, because we're quite close to it in terms of that Corbyn moment, was that the movement that surrounded that figurehead, I suppose, is that what came clear to us in our kind of work with it tangentially was that the lack of political education in that movement, the lack of really understanding what it was they were getting involved in and what the real challenges were like. And I remember I was actually on a panel with him at some thing that Armave McDay did on the Troops Out movement, and someone asked me what the importance of political education was. And I said, well, if you had good political education, you probably wouldn't have joined the Labour Party in the first place. So the room went quiet. But it was that idea that, yeah, movement building's more than just a populist figurehead. And the left have to learn that lesson because it doesn't work for us. It has worked for the right, though, but it's worked for the right for different reasons, I suppose, as you put out. The other thing that comes into that categorization of populism that's really interesting because it's become more apparent in the last 2 or 3 years is the attack on intellectualism, the attack on, you know, that I always is too clever by half. You know, I haven't been to university, but I've been to university of life. You know, all that bollocks you see here from your uncles down the pub. Mm-hmm. It becomes part of mainstream discourse. And the attack on expertise and the attack on science, which a lot of the populist right play with, because during COVID, of course, that became an important part of how you got that kind of Venn diagram connection, the two circles of the far right and conspiracy theories emerging online, this attack on expertise, this attack on science. And of course, it also comes out of and is related to the attack on people claiming that there is no such thing as climate change or climate breakdown. So that's an important part of the populist right categorization, isn't it? This idea that experts are not to be trusted, doctors are not to be trusted, don't vaccinate your kids, don't get the vaccine. That's really dangerous, isn't it?
Yeah, that's really fueled the growth of conspiracy theories. Like, of course, it's essential to question and challenge what you're being told by the political establishment, by the media. And there's, with a lot of conspiracy theories, there's a grain of truth to them.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what makes it so difficult and challenging them. And in terms of, like, the left is often categorized or condemned as part of the elite because they're preachy. And there's an element of truth in that as well. The left can be very preachy.
Yeah, you're right about that. Those elements of truth thing is really important, isn't it? Particularly within, I mean, people are right to be suspicious of Big Pharma. People are right to be suspicious of supranational institutions. People are right to be suspicious of their own governments. The problem is they're suspicious about the wrong things. You know, it's not about fucking moonlanders and Rothschilds and Jewish conspiracies and elders of Zion. It is about Davos. It is about ownership. It is about, for example, we were seeing this week in England, the raiding of water companies for massive profits over the last 20, 30 years, that those are the things people should be worried about. But it works because there's a grain of truth, as you say. The other bit about the left being preachy is a real fucking bugbear of mine, like, you know, because it's just, you know, you go into these left spaces, so-called left-wing spaces, and they're policed sometimes, not all of them, I'm not going to categorize all of them, but they're policed sometimes so effectively by people that, you know, the working people who come into those spaces, you maybe aren't that educated, maybe don't know the latest fucking rules about what you can and can't say, are hammered because of it, like, you know. And it's, whereas you want to join the right, there's no fucking hurdles to jump over. There's nothing, you just join. I mean, who do you hate? Oh, you hate that group? Yeah, come in, you're welcome, like, you know. So the left's got a lot to learn on that one, I suppose. One of the things about the populism thing was, I mean, you're looking for examples of it. There was a great example a couple of weeks ago. Do you remember Suella Braverman turned up at that kind of congregation of fucking lunatics called the National Conservative meeting? And so it was like it was a coming together of all the lunatics you could have spotted over the last 15, 20 years in Britain particularly. And it's really significant, I suppose, that a government minister was actually at it and speaking at it, because it obviously legitimizes the discussions that went on day. And if people haven't come across it, go and Google the National Conservatism Conference and look at some of the speeches online by some of the mad fringe of the far right nearly in Britain. But her speech was really fascinating, wasn't it?
Yeah, we're used to seeing these sort of events play out in the open in America. But, you know, closer to home, it hasn't been that common. But now we're seeing them organising publicly and speaking publicly amongst themselves, like, which is quite scary. But yeah, the Braverman speech was just out of the populist right playbook. You know, if you had your bingo card, like, you could have ticked off every single sort of group that was being...
Yeah, and I mean, she attacked woke culture, she attacked political correctness, she attacked revisionist history, or said we should be proud of our history. And she, that classic thing at the end there, was, which fuels as well conspiracy theories, but she said we should be sceptical of self-appointed gurus, experts and elites who think they know best, which is, as you said, straight out of the populist playbook and quite dangerous as well, you know. But the fact that that's a government minister at a, what you could argue was definitely a radical right conference. I mean, that wasn't a mainstream conservative, old school patrician Ken Clark style conference, was it?
No, it was definitely a gathering of those further to the right.
And I suppose some of the things that they were articulating there, some of those ideas of what defines this new radical right, might be interesting to, because they're not you know, you still get old school fascists and neo-Nazis about, but what defines the far right and the radical right in terms of is there anything that brings them kind of groups together in terms of what their emphases are? What do they have in common when you look at the far right in Britain, Latin America, North America, and Britain and Ireland?
Yeah, well, the contemporary far right is much more fluid and ideologically incoherent than it was, say, in the 1930s, when the threat of communism provided the central focal point for the far right. Now, we well know that threat no longer exists. And today, the far right is much more diverse, it's much more fragmented, and I suppose that reflects the fragmentation of society and politics. But the one thing that has remained constant and unifies the far right is the shared emphasis on ethnic and cultural superiority of the so-called native majority. And in the West, that's the white Christian population. You hear this referred to as nativism or ethnic nationalism, and it's an outlet which basically treats non-native forces, so that's people, institutions, and ideas, as a fundamental threat to the native culture and to the harmony of the nation state.
Yeah, so it's almost like they're trying to create or get the idea of an ethnocracy, that in order to be part of the people, back to that populist term, part of the people, and then you have the other, and the other is anyone we don't like, and the other one is anyone who's coming in, it's like alien forces coming in from the outside, whether that's Jewish conspiracies, Islamophobia, or indeed, you know, asylum seekers, refugees, and migrant workers.
Yeah, and the approach towards those groups is to exclude them or assimilate them. Those are the two options, basically. And it applies to immigrants, local non-white populations, travellers, in the case of Ireland and Britain, members of the LGBT community, and so on. Anybody who doesn't fit the bill of what it means to be a native citizen. And often that means providing relative, I don't mean absolute, privileges that improve your standard of living, but relative privileges to the so-called native population at the expense of those other groups.
Well, even if the privilege is material, it's symbolic and it's ideological and it's psychological. It's a psychological privilege. You're part of us. You're part of, you belong here. You might be living in shit with no arse in your trousers and no money, but you believe that your identity is somehow more valued by the state you live in than other people's identities, even if you're not getting any material benefits from it. Mm. Which, of course, that's the place that the left should be organising in around those material conditions that people live in, but we fail to do so for too long. I suppose one of the things that comes alongside that, and it's kind of emerged over the last 10 years, I suppose, or it's twisted and comes out of, again, the idea of Europeanism and European values. And there's a dangerous kind of, I don't know what you call it, yeah, it's a dangerous kind of ideology emerging within Europe, isn't there, about something to do with, you know, European borders, European values, the need to protect, you know, Europe from external threats, the policing of Europe's borders by that new organization, Frontex. There's some dodgy stuff happening in there, and we've heard some really nasty quotes, haven't we, from some of the EU commissioners over the last, I can't remember his name now, the one that spoke about how we have to tame the jungle, and he was referring to the rest of the world. It was really quite 19th century kind of language, wasn't it? Was it done that?
Some EU bureaucrat, I can't remember his name, but he referred to the European Union as a garden, the majority world as a jungle, basically. But you're seeing an increase of focus on European borders and values, the need to defend Europeans from external threats. And like, even within the European Union, if there are different ideas about how Europe itself should be organized, economically or politically, the unifying thread is one that protects Europe itself from these so-called external threats. That's why they're so comfortable with the likes of Orban in Hungary, because he performs a useful service in that regard. They're comfortable with working alongside Erdogan in Turkey and doing dodgy sweetheart deals with Erdogan, as long as he prevents inward migration into the EU. That's a really dangerous direction that the EU's headed in.
Of course, there are other targets for the far right in Europe. We've seen them, particularly in Poland and places, in terms of attacks on LGBT community in Spain. We've seen Vox, haven't we, with a weirdly kind of misogynistic approach and attacks on kind of modern feminism and kind of promoting the idea of, you know, the nuclear family and the role of the woman in a nuclear family. So you get this kind of benevolent sexism, old school. I mean, we taught this years ago. You get this kind of benevolent sexism happening, and then you get that hostile sexism, which is, yeah, you know, that women are a threat to democracy, they're a threat to the family, they're a threat to the security of the state. So that they're still part of the far right's belief systems, aren't they, across Europe?
Yeah, and that's exactly it. Like, the hostile sexism is that we'll, you know, we'll defend our women, our women, from the threat of those savages, those invading savages.
We saw that in Dublin during the East Wall demos, didn't we, a lot? There was a lot of that discourse flying about.
Yeah, and that goes alongside Islamophobia, anti-immigration sentiments, anti-Semitism, linked to conspiracy theories, tends to be more prevalent in Central and Eastern Europe, but also in France. It's a real problem in France. And then, like, there are more radical sounding and anti-systemic arguments that at least used to be made by the left, that we don't really live in a democracy, and that the power to influence the decisions affecting citizens has been stripped away from them, that globalization has meant a loss of sovereignty and control, and it has made life worse for large sections of the population, and that workers and communities are right to be angry about what are real material grievances in terms of wages, welfare, housing, public services, living standards. And we might not like the solutions being offered by the far right. They're very different from what we would advocate. But they have at least been offering something that sounds like a critique.
The point is, the point is, obviously, it sounds like a critique, even if they're not doing anything about it. And you're right, because we did a piece of work, didn't we, during lockdown, and we did a piece of a social listening exercise where we kind of had some analysis of the conversations that were happening online in Ireland. And one of the findings from that piece of research that we did was that the right had stolen anti-establishment language and stolen the anti-establishment discourse. So they were now not going to do anything about it, but they were critiquing, you know, neoliberalism there, which were even critiquing corrupt capitalism. Now, I don't know when you hear the word corrupt capitalism or crony capitalism, you know, you're listening to the far right, but they've at least stolen the cloak, if you like, of politics of the left, and even the stuff on globalization, that, you know, the reality that globalization has had a serious effect on workers across the globe, particularly in the global south, but also in the imperial core as well, as that we don't critique that anymore. We're not allowed to speak about that because the word globalist, the word globalism, the word globalization has been captured by the right to the point where the left and socialists can't now critique capitalism and imperialism for fear of sounding like the fucking far right. And we surely have to recapture that analysis, and we have to, not that we've lost it entirely, because if you listen to the right people, you're still going to hear it, but on the social democratic left and even on parts of the other left, you're not hearing that critique anymore, are you?
No, and those, the adoption of those more radical sounding anti-systemic arguments by the right are so much more effective whenever the left and organized labor are not sitting on their hands, but appear to be defending the status quo.
Exactly.
And like, this is how, as good as it gets, might, you know, bar a few tweaks here and there.
Yeah, I mean, when the electoral left particularly goes to the electorate and says, you know, we're not going to have austerity, we're going to have austerity lights, you know, so it's basically, you know, two cheeks of the same ass, Tweedledum and Tweedledee, and won't people know that, and they turn away from it, and it's not working. The point is, it doesn't work as an electoral strategy because people aren't that fucking stupid. And to use that quote that we always use from Daniel Singer, that if the left fail to provide, you know, rational solutions to the multiple crises we face, well, the right will turn up with irrational solutions to those crises. And that kind of describes what's happening around us today. The other thing I want to talk to you about just very briefly is that, and we made the point last time, is that, now, if you understand that fascism is capitalism in decay, that, you know, it's not just about skinheads and street movements anymore, is that fascism emerges and authoritarianism emerges as the ruling class attempt to maintain, if you like, or protect profits and maintain control over a system that's in serious trouble. And serious trouble as in permanent decline, some would argue, with the multiple and poly crises of climate breakdown and everything else, is that as things get worse, liberal capitalist democracies will turn into illiberal capitalist democracies. And we can kind of see that happening, can't we? We see this convergence, if you like, of an attempt to protect the neoliberal capitalism and authoritarianism.
Mm. Yeah. Well, the capital has always relied on authoritarian discourses and practices to sustain itself, to reproduce itself. But since the so-called war on terror, and especially since the 2008 financial crisis, we've seen increasingly authoritarian forms of governments and so-called liberal democracies. And this has been adopted as a way of managing those deepening crises of capitalism that you talk about and responding to patterns of protest and resistance that have emerged over the last couple of decades. It's the old thing of, like, the capitalist state will reveal itself when it's in crisis or feels threatened. Until then, you don't really see it.
Yeah.
It operates beneath the surface. And all of this has coincided with the resurgence of the far right. And the way that centrist parties and governments have gradually mainstreamed far-right narratives is through their increasing focus on things like immigration, crime, terrorism, culture war issues centered around identity.
Yeah.
And these are used as a distraction from questions of political economy and class conflict.
So what's the stickers we're seeing appear everywhere when they've got us fighting culture wars? You know, we're not fighting a class war. And I know I'm going to be accused of being a vulgar Marxist and a class reductionist and all those other things, but there's a truth to that as well, though, isn't there? Because it seems to be effective. Some of the ruling class have noticed these crises.
Since the 2000s, for example, the British Labour Party and the Tory Party haven't competed electorally on different visions around the economy. They generally agree on how the economy should be organised. There is no alternative.
Well, we're seeing that. We're seeing that in spoons right now, aren't we, over in Britain?
Yeah, that's it. It's just, you know, it's gradually got worse. It started in the Blair era, and it's just gradually got worse. They agree entirely on how the economy should be organised. There is no alternative. This is as good as it gets. And what they instead do is they try to outbid each other in terms of who can take the strongest line on immigration, for example.
Mm.
Who can take the strongest line on welfare scroungers, so-called welfare scroungers, or when in power, using increasingly far-right policies and rhetoric to shore up their position. And often this is used in combination with the increase in centralization of power and repression of dissent. This is the kind of authoritarianism we're talking about, and we're seeing it in Britain.
Yeah, I mean, over the last number of years, in terms of the various pieces of legislation the Conservatives have brought in to ban protests and the legislation to ban strikes, industrial action in the public sector, I mean, that you could nearly categorise the current Conservative government as a radical right government in the sense of Maloney, in the sense of Orban and Hungary, couldn't you? Without too much exaggeration.
Absolutely, and, you know, in the ballpark, like Turkey and Hungary are prime examples of this combination of authoritarian neoliberalism and far-right, increasing far-right rhetoric. Erdogan and Orban have increasingly used these methods to shore up their political position because their political positions are very precarious, right?
Yeah.
But it's also what's happened in France over a long period of time, particularly under Macron. You know, you see the attacks on the indigenous Muslim population, the attacks on immigrants, the repressive, violent clampdown on peaceful and democratic protest, and the same thing happening in Britain. So that's not something that has emerged in the East, you know, and has, you know, moved over to the West. This is all happening at the same time in different capitalist economies.
Yeah, it's a picture we see emerging. We wrote a report, as I said to our listeners here, a couple of years ago, and in the report, it was there is a subtle shift towards authoritarian neoliberalism happening, and literally over the last 2 to 3 years, you've seen it accelerate quite significantly, to the point where as the economic system goes into crisis, governments step in and need authoritarian measures to control protest because people will resist, of course, when these things happen, and we've seen that. Across Europe, not just across Europe, but Latin America too, and North America and other parts of the world.
It's happening across the board. The other thing to say, I suppose, is like what this mainstreaming of far-right ideas and narratives by centrist parties has done is help to legitimise and normalise the far-right and enable far-right formations to win electoral support and to push more and more extreme views into the mainstream. The other result is that the so-called cordon sanitaire
has gone, hasn't it? That's completely gone. I mean, the Finns party, which is it's a party that comes out of neo-Nazism, is now in government in Finland. You know, Maloney's in government in Italy as national parliament. So not just are they winning power, they're also going, moving into coalitions. I think the AfD took control of a local council there during the week in Germany. Somewhere in Germany, they're now in control of a local federal area or something. So and I think they hit 19.1%. They're now the second largest party in Germany. They've overtaken the Social Democrats. The one poll last week showed that they'd overtaken the Social Democrats on a national basis in Germany. Now, people aren't worried that a party that comes out of a neo-Nazi background is now the second largest party in Germany.
And that's the real danger, is that these ideas and narratives get mainstreamed. Far-right parties become acceptable coalition partners in the first place.
That's it.
And once they're acceptable coalition partners, then why shouldn't the government on their own? That's the impression that it gives to the public. And it grants the far-right added legitimacy, and it can prepare the ground for a far-right party to win power on its own. So
where are we going to... we haven't got a lot left on this control, but
Italy.
We can't... Okay. Go on, sorry, finish your point.
So we've seen that with Italy, you know, with the Brothers of Italy. The Lega movement prepared the ground for the Brothers of Italy, which is an outright fascist party.
Well, it wouldn't be a surprise to see the Rassemblement National, I think they're called now, the French National Front. I mean, they're the second, they were the second largest party. They were the second in the presidential elections. It wouldn't be beyond the realms of possibility to see them take control in France in the next 5 years, would it?
No, they're knocking at the door. And Macron, in trying to outbid them on the policies and the ideas that they prioritise, all he's doing is giving them added fuel. You know,
right.
Continue pushing their more and more extreme views.
I think the big hurdle in Europe, the one to watch out for, the one that's really interesting, is the CDU and the AfD. I don't see it. I don't see it happening at the moment. But you never know where they're going. I would have said that 5 years ago about other countries. And if the AfD does emerge as the second party, or is up there competing with the Social Democrats, the SPD in Germany, to one extent, that cordon sanitaire in Germany would break, because it's almost the last one left in Europe, isn't it? Because there are no coalitions in Germany at federal level between the CDU and the AfD, but that'd be an interesting one to keep an eye on. Because if that happens, then we are in the shit.
Well, the AfD is already in government at a regional level in Germany. I think it's formed a coalition with the CDU.
Oh, it hasn't. I didn't know that.
At a regional level, I can't remember the name of the region, but as you said, it's not beyond the realms of possibility to see that happen at a national level. That's how it has played out in other countries. You know, you have coalitions formed at a regional or local level in the first instance. It's tested out, and then you see it emerging at a national level. So,
of course, the centre-right have often argued in the past that, oh, don't worry, if we do have to bring them into government, we'll civilise them. You know, that we'll make sure that they come into out. But that's not what happens. It's the other way around, is that far-right narratives become mainstream, normalised, and legitimised in society more generally.
Yeah, it's not an idea of the two meeting in the middle.
Mm.
What happens is the centre-right tends to just follow the far-right and wherever it's headed.
Well, as long as the far-right protects neoliberalism, as long as the far-right protects capitalism, as long as the far-right protects profits and private ownership, the centre-right don't really give a fuck then if narratives and you know, minority groups become targeted and society becomes more nasty and brutish. And that's the point, isn't it, about fascism being capitalism in decay. As long as the far-right support the neoliberal project, then the centre-right are quite happy for them to come into government. Isn't that the bottom line?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what we're going to see.
All right, look, we're going to finish on that point. One quick question, because we are going to do a podcast in a few weeks' time about the far right in Ireland, and we're going to speak to a few people. We're going to invite a few people on, but what's your, just very briefly, your thoughts on the rise of the far right in Ireland, particularly as regards, I mean, they don't really stand, well, they do stand for election, but they haven't been elected anyway. But in terms of mainstream, in terms of far right narratives and far right ideas being mainstreamed into Irish political discourse, it hasn't happened yet, has it? Not to the extent it's happened in other parts of Europe.
No, not the ideas that you would typically characterise as far-right, but we do have extreme right-wing views in politics and society. I mean, for the best part of a century, Ireland has been a deeply conservative society with a long history of institutionalised sectarianism, racism, misogyny, homophobia. Not going to get into a history lesson, but a lot of this can be traced back to the counter-revolution of 100 years ago. That defeated the vision of an egalitarian republic. If you look at the Free State alone, you can point to a range of policies and practices that highlight its racist character.
Well, it has one of the most racist immigration policies, isn't it, in Europe?
Yeah. You're going back to the 1956 Citizenship Act.
And the 2004 Citizenship Referendum.
Yeah. right through to the dehumanizing system of direct provision. That's not to mention the state's horrific treatment of the traveler community to this day,
mm-hmm.
or the church's influence over social policy and public opinion, which has taken the form of like a particularly nasty and punitive articulation of Catholic social teaching, with all of its implications for women and children. And
I think, though, that in that sense, Ireland's prime ground, is it? I mean, you can say it's been a right-wing state, if you like, for 100 years. So it doesn't really need the growth of the far right because we're already in that position. We're already there. But I would argue, though, that Fine Gael, particularly in Fianna Fáil over the last 10 or 15 years, and trying to become good little neoliberals within the European Union, have cast some of that away from this, pushed some of those views, pushed some of those councillors and some of those politicians out, or some of those views. Certainly they're not aired publicly, are they, in the same way they were 15 years ago. That idea that neoliberalism is, yes, it's about economic liberalism, but it's also about social liberalism. That was the payoff, wasn't it, of neoliberalism? They were socially and economically liberal.
Yeah. I suppose there has been a shift on the part of those two parties, but like it's over a much longer period. It's the state and the respectable classes of the political establishment, along with the mainstream media, that has promoted a narrow and exclusive conception of Irishness and what it means to be an Irish citizen. Now, the mirror of this can be found in the more reactionary tendencies of Ulster Unionist politics and society. And then you factor in the fact that up until recently, Ireland as a whole was fairly homogenous in ethnic terms, being largely white and Christian. Mm-hmm. It's only in recent decades that it's become an area of net inward migration. This has happened over the same period as poverty and inequalities increased dramatically. The housing crisis worsened, public services have been decimated through austerity. All under the watch of Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil. And they've continued to promote, you know, racist policies. Like that Immigration Act and the application of it is one of the most exclusive and restrictive in Europe. The direct provision system is still in place.
Yeah.
And if you go at a local level in particular, and you listen to some of the Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, and even some Sinn Féin councillors, some of the things that they say about the traveller community is totally horrific.
Yeah. I think it's something we have to return to, actually, to see the nature of the Irish state, the Free State in particular, you know, because it does usually come out of a very reactionary 100-year history, but it's had this 20-year neoliberal period where, on the face of it, you know, they sound more European, they sound more like based on, you know, positive European values, but as we know, even that's shifting, and meanwhile, their policies have stayed deeply racist.
And I suppose the point I'd make is that the far right is building on the reactionary tendencies that have long existed in society and in the political spectrum.
Ireland's fertile ground for the growth of a proper far right, do you think?
Yeah, well, they haven't come from nowhere. You know, they don't exist in a vacuum. And of course, they're becoming more interconnected with international talking points and international networks and all that sort of stuff. But fundamentally, they're still rooted in Irish conditions.
Yeah, I think we'll come back to this one, actually, and we'll focus a little bit more on the far right in Ireland. All right, and thanks for that, Sean. Cheers, everyone, for listening to our 98th podcast. You're very welcome to listen to the next one. We'll have to do a celebratory one for number 100. I don't know what we'll do yet, but we'll come up with something. Thanks for listening. Sláinte fóill.
That, comrades, was Trademark Belfast. Thanks so much for listening in. We'll see you soon, either in the trenches or on the victory parade. Up the workers, and Sláinte fóill.